Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we'll meet a local clinical psychologist who says LGBTQ plus young people are not doing well.
And how a prison exchange program changed one ASU student's life.
But first, Democrats across the country had a big election night last night, winning governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey, as well as banking a win for the headline-grabbing new mayor of New York City, Zohran Mamdani. Here in Arizona, most of the issues on your ballot yesterday were bonds and overrides to fund local school districts, and there was a big effort to vastly expand mental health coverage for Valleywise Health. But there was one highly political race on the ballot in Mesa, a recall effort to oust Republican Julie Spilsbury from the Mesa City Council, which was spurred by far-right activists with Turning Point USA. She conceded defeat late last night to challenger Dorian Taylor. Cameron Sanchez with our politics desk is here now to tell us more. Did you get much sleep there, Cameron?
I got like 4 hours, but that was not the election's fault. I stayed up late for no reason.
Ah, okay. So let's dive in here. Starting with this recall effort in Mesa, Julie Spilsbury and her challenger are both Republicans. So these are nonpartisan races, mm-hmm. right? But Spilsbury wasn't basically conservative enough for the folks at Turning Point USA. What did she do?
No, she didn't pass the test anymore. Back in 2024, she endorsed a couple of Democrats. That was Kamala Harris and Ruben Gallego. And that did not play well because even though the Mesa City Council is nonpartisan, they felt that she was not being a good enough Republican and was sort of betraying the party. Part of the recall effort cited also some votes that she took on a mm-hmm. couple of different issues, but she was not the only one who voted that way. And obviously, she was the only one who had this recall effort against her. So, you know, it's generally concluded, including by her, that that was the main reason that they went after her.
That's interesting. There's a bit of a history of this kind of Republican politics in Mesa in particular, right?
Right. John Giles, the former mayor, and he is kind of known for being what they call a rhino or Republican in name only because he was willing to endorse Democrats and is not a fan of President Trump, although he still considers himself to be a Republican. And I think they're very much intertwined because Spilsbury said that it was Giles who actually came to her and asked her to run in the first place. Mm. You know, they're somewhat affiliated. They know one another. And it's sort of an instance, I think, of history repeating itself with that type of Republican.
What did she have to say about this loss? You spoke with her yesterday, right?
I did.
I don't want partisan politics to come into our city. I don't want them to come onto our city council. I think it's really important that we have different opinions, different ideas, different political parties, different backgrounds.
It sounds like she was a little emotional about all of this.
She was. And I mean, that's not really surprising, right? She was not expecting, of course, to have to run this race in 2025 in this local election. She had just been reelected in 2024 with like 65% of the vote, which is pretty high, pretty overwhelming. And now, you know, about a year later, she's losing to this person who's coming out of nowhere.
Yeah. Okay. So you also spoke with the challenger here who won the race, mm-hmm. who's been pretty mum until now. What did Dorian Taylor have to say?
Well, everyone will have a bias no matter which party they're in, whether you're independent, you're Democrat, you're Republican, you're green. So I think it's important to tell that to your voters so that if they don't talk to you, they kind of have an idea of which way you're going to vote.
Mm. So tell us more about what she had to say, Cameron.
So she said that partisanship does matter because even though Mesa City Council and other city councils are nonpartisan offices, it gives people, like she just said, a sense of what you stand for. But on the other hand, she said that partisanship shouldn't be the main point in how you're voting on certain things like keeping roads clean and safe and fixing potholes, stuff like that. But on issues like finances, for example, or taxes, she says it's important for voters to know if you're going to be what she calls fiscally conservative or not. Mm,
okay. So partisan politics making its way into city government here. Mm. There was also pretty high turnout for this race, right?
Yeah. I mean, in these off-year elections, I mean, this is a local election. It's not high-profile races like president or governor. So we don't typically see super high turnout. It's unsurprising to see turnout in the teens. But for this race, yeah, it was relatively high. It was, I think, 30-something percent turnout.
Okay. This also came on a night, Cameron, as I outlined at the top there, when Democrats on a lot of these national races, you know, did really well. Mm-hmm. And these were races that, you know, a lot of politicos are watching. So this race in Mesa, Freedom Caucus leader, one of the leaders of Turning Point USA, Tyler Boyer, called this one of the most important races in the country. Does this seem like to you, Cameron, that this race was a bellwether for Arizona voters?
I think this race is a really important case study because, well, for several reasons. But I mean, Turning Point is obviously very high profile now nationwide because of the death of Charlie Kirk recently. And here in Arizona, you know, they've been a presence for a long time, but I think people are more aware of it than usual. And Turning Point has a huge presence. So they were able to send in, you know, volunteers and put out this massive, massive effort against Spilsbury, which she really, you know, couldn't compete with. And so I wonder if that's, you know, a sign of things to come, maybe for more local elections like this. There's going to be more of an effort to make them partisan, more of an effort to recall folks who don't toe the line properly, stuff like that. And also kind of a test, a show of Turning Point's power in the wake of the assassination. And, you know, Tyler Boyer's the head of their political arm. So his statement putting a lot of importance on this makes it seem like this is where their focus is.
Yeah, it's really interesting stuff. OK, so there were also a lot of other issues on the ballot yesterday. Voters weighed in on a variety of bonds and overrides. It seems like two mixed results. We'll talk more about that later. But let's talk briefly before I let you go, Cameron, about Prop 409. This was the only issue on every Maricopa County voters ballot yesterday. It's an effort to pass an $898 million bond for Maricopa County's safety net hospital Valleywise Health and to fund mental health, behavioral health care. Mm-hmm. It's narrowly passing as of this morning.
Yeah, just squeaking by there, which is, I think, interesting for a few reasons. This is such a huge price tag attached, right? That sounds like so much money, $900 million, even though it's over the course of several years. But it's showing that voters are interested in going forward with this Valleywise system. And they approved something back in 2014, which was a smaller price tag, but for the hospital. And so it looks like that's continuing, although I believe back in 2014, that measure passed with a much higher percentage. So it seems like maybe the price tag is putting people off a little bit, but not so much that they weren't willing to continue to invest in Valleywise expansion.
Okay. Last question for you. I got to my polling place locally last night, just kind of before it closed, to drop off my ballot. And I was surprised there were a lot of voters there. There was a line of cars coming in, people directing traffic. What did turnout look like in this kind of off-year election? This was usually very low turnout, right?
Usually very low turnout. And also these are mail elections, right? So everyone gets their ballot in the mail, whether you asked for it to come in the mail or not. And so you have the option of sending it back. I think part of it is procrastination. You know, we're all human. Maybe people wanted to drop off last minute.
Definitely,
but in general, I do think that there was a larger turnout. So I think it's a mixture of people, you know, showing up in person more than maybe they usually would, and also being more interested whether it was a particular, you know, bond or override or other ballot measure that brought them out.
Yeah. Okay. Lots to watch for still, but some interesting results rolling in. That is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez with our politics desk joining us. Cameron, hope you get some sleep tonight.
Thank you. Me too.
Low-income Arizonans are already dealing with financial stress stemming from the ongoing government shutdown and other federal cuts. Now they are facing potential price hikes on their utility bills. At a recent town hall in Sun City about this issue, Attorney General Chris Mays said that electricity prices in Arizona have risen faster in the past 2 years than in the previous nine. And those costs may get even higher in the coming months. Joining us now to explain why this is happening is Kelly McGowan, the executive director of Wildfire, an organization working to fight poverty. Kelly, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. To start, give us a sense of what we might be seeing in terms of these rate hikes. What sorts of increases would customers be looking at?
Yeah, well, I think we are seeing across the nation that we have data that electricity prices are climbing more than twice as fast as inflation, and we're seeing that here locally, certainly. We've got most of our major utilities coming in for rate cases at our Arizona Corporation Commission over the next couple months to year. APS is coming in for a 14% increase. That's after a 2023 increase of about 8%, although that was base rate increase. It was higher based on some other factors. We have TEP, Tucson Electric Power, coming in for a 14% increase. And then SRP just recently in November had a price proceeding that resulted in an increase across the board for customers.
What reasons are the utilities giving for needing these hikes?
A lot of varying reasons. I mean, we have just growth in general. Our population continues to grow, and that's increased demand on the grid for serving more customers. And we're having the impacts of climate change here, and the utilities are citing the need to protect against major catastrophes like wildfires and the floods that we just saw out in the Globe area. They also cite that, like our costs are increasing, their costs are increasing. So inflation is impacting them, interest rates, just like they're impacting our daily lives and our bills. So data centers certainly play into that growth. In addition to just customer growth, we're seeing large users of our electric grid coming in for building out these data centers, which is certainly going to impact rates.
So as I mentioned at the beginning, your organization, Wildfire, advocates in particular on behalf of low-income Arizonans. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the particular impacts of all this on low-income folks, because some people might be listening to this and thinking, if my bill went up by $20 a month, that would be frustrating, perhaps, but not necessarily debilitating. It's not the case for everybody.
Correct. And we've got some really good data that comes from the Census Bureau on a pretty regular basis. And so here in Arizona, in the last 12 months, we know that about 46% of households had one indicator of energy insecurity. And I'm going to talk you through a couple of these. 21% were unable to pay their electric bill in full. 27% kept their houses at unsafe temperatures to lower the bill. And about 36% forewent expenses for other basic needs, food, medicine, to try to pay that utility bill. So we're seeing real impacts for low-income households choosing between which bill to pay and to try to stay housed, frankly.
Yes, and these are, it's no exaggeration to say, life and death issues in some cases, especially here in the Valley when the heat gets really intense. There has also been some news recently about the state's Corporation Commission working to repeal energy efficiency standards. Can you give us some context on that? Why are they trying to do that? And what would the implications be if they are, in fact, repealed?
Yeah, so all five commissioners on our Arizona Corporation Commission voted to begin the repeal process of the energy efficiency standard. And that will be an ongoing process that we're going to encourage consumers to come out and share their thoughts. But some of the things that they cited in that meeting where the opening of the repeal took place were that they met the standards that were put in place when we adopted these measures as a state. A desire to understand individual program by individual program, which ones are working and which ones are not, were the two main reasons. And so that those costs don't get passed on to consumers across the rate base. Now, as advocates, we think that energy efficiency programs show that they can reduce bills, and particularly for low-income families, we're very concerned about that repeal. One of the largest programs that we have is the weatherization program, and that program goes into low-income households and looks at the household as a whole to see what we can do to reduce energy burden in that household, lower bills, and increase efficiency. And so for programs like that to potentially be taken away reduces our impact to lower low-income households' energy bills.
So as we've been talking about, Wildfire works on behalf of poor folks. You also do actively partner with the utilities in some cases. Talk a little bit about that collaboration. How does that serve your larger aims at Wildfire?
Yeah, to their credit, all of the utilities look to provide funding and programs to help their low-income customer base. That helps us all. That helps their entire rate base. And so we partner with all of the state's utility programs to run bill assistance programs for households who are unable to pay their energy bill, and also then to run programs to help families replace utility-related appliances. So we get funding from all of the state's utilities to help families replace their HVAC systems, because $10,000 is a mighty bill for a low-income household. So in SRP's current price proceeding, they increased their bill assistance from $1 million to $5 million. So that will be a huge help. And both in the TEP and APS rate cases that we see pending, there is additional support for low-income households.
Kelly, we've got just about 30 seconds left here. I'm wondering if you could give us some national context on this. You alluded to the fact that this is a nationwide issue. Any takeaways from how we saw the elections last night play out in terms of what we've been discussing here?
Yeah, we keep hearing that electricity prices are going to be a campaign issue. And I think you saw that play out in last night's election. We have two governors who spoke about that on the campaign trail. We had a commission in Georgia switch parties with a nod to what electricity prices mean there. So I think that will continue to play out in Arizona as we have upcoming elections across the next year.
Well, Kelly McGowan is the executive director at Wildfire. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, an unincorporated community in the far Northwest Valley is debating whether a new railroad hub should be built, and some residents have concerns.
And really, our concerns have been the same since I've been in office and probably a few years before that. But specifically, it's about wastewater, transportation, and public safety. I think those are the three things that will truly impact the city of Surprise if this project is completed.
The mayor of the city of Surprise tells us what he's hearing from constituents.
But first, researchers at the LGBTQ plus advocacy organization, the Trevor Project, have been following nearly 1,700 young people for the last 2 years, measuring their mental health amid an unprecedented rise in anti-LGBTQ legislation. Their latest results are out now, and, well, these folks are not doing well. The report found worsening mental health distress among these young people. Anxiety symptoms rose to 68%, depression to 54%. Those thinking about suicide is up to 47%. And it's all worst for transgender and non-binary teens. It's a trend our next guest is seeing firsthand. Dr. Joshua Kellison is a licensed clinical psychologist and the founder of the Sexual Orientation and Gender Institute of Arizona. I spoke with him more about it, and he told me up until recently, things had been getting better for LGBTQ plus youth.
So one of the best books that came out, I think, earlier on was like The New Gay Teen. And it was talking about how these youth are no longer experiencing internalized homophobia and are coming out sooner and all these wonderful things. Then you started to see a switch, that pendulum swinging back. And here in the Valley, we saw a lot more kids feeling more suicidal, engaging in high-risk behaviors like substance use or alcohol use, or engaging in high-risk sexual behaviors and things like that. So that pendulum swung back. And as the current administration continues, we start to see that increase again.
So tell us what you think is behind that. We've seen community centers resources close, lose funding, completely shut down. I mean, it sounds like your referrals are going up because of this.
Yeah. So what we saw for any federally funded hospital, for example, if they are in fear of losing their funding, they may need to shut down services that might have been, for example, gender-affirming medical care. And so, for example, Phoenix Children's Hospital and several other institutes and things of that nature had to reduce access to those forms of care. Mm-hmm. That being said, we rallied and we supported our youth in terms of being able to have access to care from other agencies. At the same time, there is a current crisis in mental health where there's not enough providers and there's not enough resources in terms of insurance, and then the fear of access to care for youth and the stigma of going and getting that kind of help, that professional help, feels wrong or bad. And so, unfortunately, those cases tend to then isolate, mm-hmm. and we see these problems occur.
Tell us about some of the folks that you work with and what you're hearing from these kids.
Yeah, the worst that I'm seeing, there's a few things that I've been seeing. Well, first of all, the amount of people that are considering leaving, not just the state, to go to a state where there's access to medical care for their gender, non-binary or gender diverse youth, but they're going off out of the country. And so recently I had three families make that very challenging and difficult decision to leave the country. And in fact, I just actually got an update from one of my families who chose to move to Ireland, mm-hmm. and they're now waiting to get their asylum. And so
they applied for asylum in Ireland based on the changes in transgender care in the United States.
Yeah. The issue is because it's not just the states that are having some of these difficulties, but the federal government is putting fear in not just the families, but the providers. So in Texas, we saw that for a while people could report that these families were gaining access to care for their children, and those neighbors or family members would report them and get paid. Mm. That was short-lived, but the idea that these kinds of things can happen was so fear-mongering, and rightly so, by the way, that these families had to make the decision, like, before it gets too bad, the writing's on the wall, we have to get out of here before it's too late. Mm. And so selling their homes, leaving their careers, leaving their families, leaving their religious institutions, all kinds of resources. And we as psychologists have to prepare those families for that transition. And so that has been learning on the ground, because there was no training for that.
Right. But. Like, this is new territory for somebody like you. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is confusion among parents, right? Like, that there used to be sort of a script, like, or a path that they could follow if they had a kid who's transgender to get care and to do, you know, what the medical establishment recommends. And that's sort of questioned now.
Yes. Unfortunately, because of some of the science deniers and health deniers and medical establishment deniers, and now parents are questioning, like, do you really know what you're kind of talking about? Is this really true? Is this the best care that we can provide our kids? Are they really suicidal? Are you sure about that? So just kind of going over the results of some of the assessments that we give. But these measures are tried and true and are evidence-based, so scientifically proven to work with various populations at different ages.
Is the whole conversation around conversion therapy coming up again?
Yes. And I always tell people that I will not do that. I follow the client where they are, and they lead me on their journey. I'm just there as a participant to supporting them. I've had some family members talk about those kinds of things, and part of the grief response when a child comes out for some parents is sometimes negotiation, which is one of those Kubler-Ross stages of grief where we negotiate or bargain when we learn about death. And so if you go to this conversion therapy place, then I can support you in terms of getting a car or something else if you go through this really painful experience of trying to change you into something that you may or may not be, but something that could cause more problems and long-term mental health challenges that increase that internalized transphobia.
Did you ever think we'd be back here? Like, it sounds like this is a lot of stuff that was, you know, put to bed for some time, like that was not acceptable, and now it's back in the debate.
Not in my lifetime. I mean, I'll get emotional things just thinking about it. Like, having gone through some of those things myself as a youth, and then thinking that we had surpassed and we had gotten so far, that I did not think that this would come back as it has now in this such a profound and fast, unrelenting way, that it's just every day there's another thing that these youth then come in and we're talking about, and I have to support them in digesting this information and helping them to cope with social political distress rather than coping with just being a teenager. Just being a teenager is hard enough. And now we have to talk about what the current administration has said and or doing, and the threats that they're making, and all that fear, and all of that is just a sense of control. So I again continue to encourage them to live their best lives and as authentic as they can possibly be.
I wonder if there's a silver lining in this report at all. Like, were there any tidbits in here that you felt like, you know, this is good?
There were a few hopeful signs that I saw. And one of them that was really inspiring was the fact that even though there was this higher increase in folks that felt like they did not have access to care just due to costs and in terms of people having open slots, and just some of the stigma that they were feeling about that. At the same time, there was a statistically significant amount of youth that reported wonderful results in terms of their experience of therapy. Mm. So they felt good after leaving those sessions. They felt less suicidal in leaving those sessions. And the other thing is that those that have attempted suicide have actually gone down. It was 11% to 7%. So the actual ones that have attempted has reduced in a significant way.
Last question for you, Dr. Kellison. I wonder if there's a client, a story, a moment in all of this that really stands out to you that you'd like to tell folks about.
I have lots of stories, and there's a lot of youth who come to mind over the past 15 years that I've been working in this area. But one that comes to mind that I think about all the time. They came to me early on with such significant distress, and they were actively suicidal, actively attempting suicide. And as they began to accept themselves, and their family members were also in the full model DBT or dialectical behavioral therapy program that we offer at our institute, and then the youth started accepting themselves and the parents were doing such an excellent job of providing that support to that youth. That youth no longer engages in self-harm. Mm. They now are at a university doing very well, and they're loving themselves, and they're in a relationship that they thought they would never have. And I'm just so proud of them because they were able to turn their lives around through that self-acceptance and also the skills-based work that they learn from a treatment program.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. Dr. Joshua Kellison, the founder and director of clinical services and training for the Sexual Orientation and Gender Institute of Arizona. Dr. Kellison, thank you for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren. It was my pleasure.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Back in the late 1990s, Lori Pompa, a professor at Temple University, had an idea. What if her students took a semester-long course alongside inmates at a Pennsylvania prison? What, she wondered, could the students learn from the inmates? What could the inmates learn from the students? In 1997, Pompa launched a program where that's exactly what happens. It's called the Inside Out Prison Exchange Program. Since then, chapters of the program have sprung up all over the country, including right here in the Valley. Alexis Clem is a PhD student in criminology at ASU, and she says the program changed her life. After she completed a semester of the Inside Out program as an undergrad, she returned as a facilitator, and she continues to lead gatherings of students and inmates as part of her ongoing research. I spoke with Clem recently about her experience, and she told me that she first got interested in justice reform from watching crime procedurals on TV. Like a lot of people, she was compelled by the mystery-solving element of shows like Law & Order and Criminal Minds, but she always had a hunch there was more to the story.
I think there was always this level of unknown that I think was fascinating to me, and then as I got older, I dove more into what that unknown meant to different degrees. And that's when I really got interested in criminal justice and criminology overall.
So tell me a little bit more about that unknown. What was it that you wanted to investigate there?
I think it was this desire to understand perhaps how people end up in particular circumstances. And oftentimes, I think Hollywood productions of crime and those kind of shows show it in a very particular way and don't often get into that background of what could have potentially led someone there.
So like in the show, there's the unknown of like, are they going to be found guilty or, you know, which way is the trial going to go? But there's this bigger unknown, which is the context of how the person got caught up in this situation.
Absolutely. And I think the context is important, especially as we start looking to real life outside of, again, outside of shows and movies and Hollywood depictions of these things. Context is incredibly important. And you see the importance of context in the way that the system operates and also people who are impacted by the system and within the system, how that context matters to the way they navigate it.
So let's come now to you get to ASU and you find out about the Inside Out program.
Yes.
What drew you to it?
It was interesting. It was an on-the-ground kind of hands-on, if you will, experience within the system that isn't often offered within kind of traditional modalities of learning in university. I also was kind of always interested in corrections and prisons as a potential career path post-graduation. This class gives an insight into the prison system that I know I wasn't getting from lecture-based, textbook-based learning at the university.
One of the things I am intrigued about that I think you've spoken about previously is this idea of discomfort and that was something that was important to you.
I attribute a lot of the way that I feel about this topic to having taken Inside Out. It's a concept that I learned as a student within Inside Out and now as a facilitator continue to really emphasize. But this idea of embracing discomfort, being okay with being uncomfortable.
It seems like to some extent it's baked in to the design of this program, right? Because am I correct that the classes take place at the prison?
Correct. It's a semester-long class, and we meet once a week for 3 hours at a time within the prison setting. It's usually 10 ASU undergraduate students and 10 incarcerated students in a classroom. And when I took the class as a student, which was back in 2019, I took it at the women's prison, and we weren't in a classroom per se. We were in the visitation room. And so it's the same kind of big open space with windows that you can see out onto the yard. And this is where people visit with their families and their loved ones over the weekends, and this is their space for connection to the outside community. Certainly not a traditional classroom setting that most people would think of.
Yeah, I could imagine that being sort of fertile territory for discomfort.
Absolutely. And I think it takes a bit to admit that discomfort. There's a level of discomfort for everybody on all sides, all parties involved. I would argue, and I can speak as a facilitator of the program now, there's a level of discomfort for facilitators and what it means to have this class of 20 people interacting. We're talking about ASU students, undergraduate students, who this is more than likely their first experience ever within the system. Perhaps they've taken a tour of a courthouse or a jail at some point in time, but to really process through the facility on a weekly basis, sit next to women who are wearing orange. And then on the flip side of that, it's perhaps women who have not interacted with someone of that age group for a long time. We're talking across generational learning that's occurring here and concepts that are new to each group respectively. And everybody's really learning from each other. But there is naturally some discomfort that comes along with that.
As I understand it, there is a syllabus. Mm-hmm. But part of the focus also is the way the learning is done as much as it is the exact content of what is being taught.
Absolutely. There's a syllabus. There's books. Everybody reads the same books throughout the semester. You write papers throughout the semester. There's a class project at the end, which always proves fun to be a part of, but also to witness from a distance, seeing 20 people, again, across all the varying differences and backgrounds come together to produce a final product. But it's true. The class is really made up based on the experiences that you have within it on a day-to-day, based on the interactions and the discussion. Pretty much the entirety of the 3 hours are different activities where you're up and moving around and discussions that you are in small groups or partnered up, or sometimes we have large group discussions. It's very dynamic, and it's a big reason why we call the instructors facilitators, because it's truly a facilitation of the program, not a teaching of anything super specific. I will say that a majority of the content that we teach it's really human-centered. It's not based on justice. You don't go into this class. You're not taking a Criminal Justice 100 class, just so happens to be in a prison. You're taking a class about what it means to learn, what it means to prioritize the things that matter to you, what it means to be a better person regardless of circumstances.
The 2019 class, among other things, published this letter of 10 key takeaways. And one of those was meaning can be found in the smallest of things. Was there, in that spirit, some small moment or interaction in the class that became meaning-making for you?
One of the most powerful things that came out of that class for me was that I went into it, again, having what I like to think is a reasonable understanding of the system, having been in school, having done my own personal learning and looking into what the system is, what it does, what its challenges are. But then you get in there and you see firsthand the challenges. You learn of the experiences of the people who are experiencing incarceration or of the correctional staff who are in there. You see the challenges firsthand. You see the gaps and you start to see where you fit in them. And I think that's what really was powerful for me, is because going into this, I still have the big dreams of supporting large-scale policy change or legislation that can make positive changes within our system. But it's also more so important to me at this stage in my career, particularly, that I'm there, I'm on the ground, I'm interacting with the people who are experiencing it firsthand, whose lives are continuing while we wait on all those big changes down the line. There are people currently within the system right now that don't have time to wait on the big changes, and there are ways to communicate effectively and respectfully within those contexts that could allow the work and the conversations and the interactions to be far more effective and positive with better outcomes.
Well, Alexis Klemm is a doctoral student in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at ASU. Alexis, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much. It was great to speak with you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The Maricopa County Board of Supervisors later this morning is expected to vote on one of a couple of issues dealing with a controversial development proposal in the far West Valley. BNSF Railroad wants to develop a rail hub in Whitman, an unincorporated community northwest of Surprise. The more than $3 billion project would include a logistics park, a logistics center, and an intermodal facility. The overall Logistic Park Phoenix, or LPP development, would incorporate more than 4,000 acres. The railroad says having all three of those facilities in one place would increase efficiencies, and supporters tout the project's economic benefits. But critics worry about the impact it'd have on that part of the valley. That includes some Whitman residents, as well as a nearby school district, and the Surprise City Council, which approved a resolution opposing the development. Kevin Sartor is the mayor of Surprise. He spoke with our co-host, Mark Brody, who asked about his main concerns with the facility in Whitman.
You know, I've been in office for about 10 months now, almost 11, and really our concerns have been the same since I've been in office and probably a few years before that. But specifically, it's about wastewater, transportation, and public safety. I think those are the three things that will truly impact the city of Surprise if this project is completed.
All right, so let's talk about each of those. Wastewater, are you concerned about the facility generating wastewater or its excess use of water in your community?
Well, this, you know, we're a rapidly growing city. And, you know, as we're growing, we're working with developers to come up with, you know, smart growth solutions. And one of those solutions is to, you know, have regional, you know, in this case, water solutions. And so BNSF acquired Type 2 water rights, which doesn't require them to put the water that they pump out of the ground back into the ground. And so our concern is that it'll impact, you know, the aquifers, impact, you know, our regional solution. And so we've, you know, tried to work with them to come up with, you know, bring them into our regional solution, but we just haven't been able to get to that point yet.
All right. So you also mentioned transportation. What are your concerns there?
Well, again, Mark, with our city growing as quickly as it is, we have US 60 or Grand Avenue that runs through our city. And we also have Loop 303 that intersects with that. And so the northwest part of Surprise is where our main growth is at. And with the growth that we have, it already has become an issue with transportation, people getting in and out of the area, emergency response, those types of things. And so, you know, when we talk about BNSF and, you know, full build out, they'll add 20,000 truck trips. If we were to do that with the current infrastructure we have, it would just be a complete mess. And so, you know, we're trying to work with them to come up with solutions. And again, we just haven't come to anything concrete yet.
All right. And thirdly, you mentioned public safety. What are your concerns with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's in Whitman and it's county out there. And so
yeah,
the way that, you know, police and firework, especially fire, it's the automated, you know, aid system. And so the closest, you know, that's available would respond. So our concern is that, you know, if you have this huge railplex and industrial area, if there was something were to happen, that our police and fire would be called out there and not be ready to respond here in the city of Surprise. And so we just want to work on a solution that, you know, fixes that or at least helps support the city in accomplishing that.
Do you have any measure of optimism that the folks at BNSF can come to an agreement with the Surprise officials and come up with something that can work for everybody?
You know, I think it's really just about, it's not just about talking about it. It's about, you know, I always, from my perspective as mayor, it's about deeds, not words. And so, you know, we've been talking about, since I've been in office, a few years before I took office, you know, the city staff, elected officials have been working with BNSF, and we just haven't really come up with any concrete solutions. And so I don't think it lies solely with the city of Surprise. I mean, the decision is ultimately with the county at this point. And so I think they really have to do a lot to work with, you know, the local municipality, I think work with county and state to come up with a solution. It's a regional impact, and we just haven't heard that or any solutions from BNSF.
Have you heard anything from folks at the county about which way they're leaning or whether they share your concerns?
I've talked with Supervisor Lesko on the matter. We've met a few times, but I mean, I don't want to speak for her and what her opinion is. But as far as I'm aware, the way that the project sits right now, she's not supporting it.
Do you think there is a way to get Surprise on board? Like you mentioned, you know, the sort of those three areas of concern, like can there be enough movement both from BNSF and maybe some movement from you and your colleagues on the city council to get to a place where this facility can go up and everybody can at least live with it?
Well, you know, the city of Surprise, you know, we support thoughtful and responsible economic development. And we're pro-business and we're good with growth, but it has to be responsible growth. And so, and we have to have good partners. And so that's really our concern with BNSF is that, you know, we've talked about a lot of things, but nothing has really been put into any, you know, concrete developmental agreements, anything like that. And so I think until we get to a point where we're actually coming up with solutions, and I know the city staff has worked a lot on this and tried to reach out and we're still talking to BNSF, but until there's an actual solution on the table, I just don't see us coming, you know, to support it.
So you mentioned that you are pro-business and, you know, not opposed to economic development. And supporters of this project point out that this could potentially have a pretty significant economic development for the Northwest Valley. Do you see this project that way, assuming that you can come to an agreement on addressing the concerns that you've addressed?
You know, Mark, I think when you look at a city and its profile and when we talk about economic development and workforce, you know, they're going to have jobs at the BNSF, you know, facility, but I just don't know if it fits with the profile of our city. You know, we're a young up and coming city, highly educated, skilled workforce. And so I just don't know if it's the right alignment between what jobs they're going to bring and what the residents of Surprise in their talents. I just don't think it's an alignment. So there will be jobs for sure. But again, I think it's a misalignment of what the city of Surprise has to offer and what BNSF is going to offer as far as employment goes.
Well, it kind of sounds, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it kind of sounds like even if BNSF is able to address your concerns, you're not fully convinced this is the best use for that space and maybe the best project for your community.
You know, I think for the city of Surprise, you know, again, we're a growing community. And so there's a lot of land. We're about 320 square miles of land. And while this is in our planning area, it's not in our city limits at this point. And so I think, you know, as we're growing, we have to evaluate all projects and, you know, how much of a benefit it's going to be to the city of Surprise.
You kind of alluded to this, but I want to ask more specifically. It sounds like there are still conversations going on between city officials and the railway. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. We're not opposed to growth. We're not opposed to working towards solutions. It's just as a council, we realized we weren't making any progress on any of those solutions. And so we just wanted to come together, stand united as a council and say, this is our perspective. When we have the resolution, we outlined some of the very specific things that, you know, have occurred and what we'd like to see happen. And we're looking forward to continuing working with BNSF to find the solutions.
All right. That is Kevin Sarter, the mayor of the city of Surprise. Mayor Sarter, thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for your time.
We also reached out to BNSF about this project. In a statement, a spokesperson said in part that discussions continue with ADOT, the Maricopa County Department of Transportation, MAG, and the City of Surprise to identify traffic mitigation strategies. Once finalized, we will present these significant commitments, which will complement the substantial economic benefits of the LPP project, including the creation of over 76,000 jobs, nearly $4 billion in labor income, and $258 million annually in state and local tax revenue, supporting schools, community colleges, flood control, and other public services in Maricopa County. You can read the company's full statement at theshow.kjzz.org.
Well, thank you for listening to the show on this Wednesday. We hope you'll be back with us again tomorrow. Remember, Thursday, always a fun day on the show because you don't just get the show. If you are subscribed, you will also get our weekly newsletter, Radio Heads. where we have lots of bonus content and all kinds of extra interesting stuff that we can't always fit into the show itself. Sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. For Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman. We will talk to you tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.